This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Is your pet stressed out? Does your pet need annual vaccines? Which pet is best for a child? Would you know if your dog was in pain? Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor, where you'll learn everything about keeping your pet healthy and happy. From pet care, pet meds and grooming, to pet food, pet insurance and dental care, this is the place to find out everything there is to know about pet wellness. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets, because it's your pet. Health matters. Please welcome your Pet Doctor host, veterinary media consultant and veterinarian, Dr. Bernadine Cruz.
You saw it at the pet store and immediately fell in love with it. You really don't know what it is, but you just have to have it. The guy at the store said it was easy to take care of. No problem. Not any harder than a cat, dog, or hamster. Now you have a betta fighting fish, baby cockatoo, sugar slider, ferret, prairie dog, bearded lizard. You got the idea. Fill in the blank. You Googled how to take care of it. You looked at some YouTube videos. Now you have that sinking suspicion that your great new non-traditional pet may be more than you can handle. Now what? Now you need the assistance of a veterinarian like my guest, Krista Keller. She is a veterinarian and specialist in zoological medicine, assistant professor of zoological medicine, Department of Veterinary Clinical Medicine, College of Veterinary Medicine, University of Illinois. We're going to be right back after this short break, so stay tuned. This is going to be fascinating.
Does your dog itch, scratch, stink, or shed like crazy? Come to Dynavite for help.
Order a 90-day supply of Dynavite.
Dynavite for life.
Pick up two tubes of Dogosuds.
Get the third tube free.
Peppermint, tea tree, lavender, Dogosud shampoo.
Made with all-natural coconut, jojoba, aloe. Great for healthy skin and soft, shiny coats.
But no itchy, harsh chemicals.
Lather up, rinse away.
Try Dogosuds. Buy two, get one free.
At Dynavite.com.
Dynovite.com.
Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Dr. Keller, I so appreciate you being on today. I think most of the listeners always said as a kid, oh, I wanted to be a veterinarian. And most young veterinarians said, oh, I always wanted to be a zoological vet. And I did an internship at the LA Zoo, but you did it. Both fronts. Congratulations. And again, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. Thanks. That sounds great.
Well, since 2008, I've had a lot of different specialists on the show, but I really think that you're the first zoological vet that I've had, specialist. How many of there are you in the United States?
Well, we're growing every year. So the American College of Zoological Medicine has, I think it's like 230 specialists now, but every year we add, you know, 10 to 15 more, and we're a growing college, but we're a very small group of individuals.
So being a zoo vet, and I know that you're there at the College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Illinois, do you also go to zoos too, or now you just at university?
Yeah, a lot of people, I say I'm a zoo vet because I'm, you know, a specialist in zoological medicine. And I think most people identify the word zoo with a traditional zoo where you go and you see elephants and, you know, maybe some seals and rhinos. And so they say, what zoo do you work at? And really the field of zoological medicine, even though there's not a lot of us, is a pretty broad field. So there's a lot of individuals who are zoo vets that work in that traditional setting at a zoo. There's zoo vets that work in aquaria, and most of their patients are fish and maybe some aquatic invertebrates. There's people like me who work on zoologic companion animals. So kind of those weird and wacky species that are part of people's families, or some of the more non-traditional pet species. And then there's people who work with free-ranging wildlife and are going out and looking at, you know, why bison are dying in Yellowstone, or why California sea lions are having an epidemic of herpes virus off the coast of California. So it's a pretty broad field. In academia, my main job is to educate the next generation of veterinarians and veterinary zoo specialists, which is really fun. And part of that does bring me to some local zoos. So we have, we take care of 2 zoos here in Illinois, and we go out there once or twice a week and take care of their zoo animals. So I do some more traditional zoo work as well, although it's not the main part of my job.
Well, my little heart is going, wow, that is so lucky. I am just so enamored of everything that you do. All right, so that's kind of an overview of what zoological veterinarians do. What is a typical day in the life of Dr. Krista Keller?
Yeah, is there a typical day, I guess, would be, you know, it's hard. I think most veterinarians in general are drawn to the fields because of the variety. You know, every day is a little bit different. You never know what's going to walk through the door. And I think in zoological medicine, it's the same way. However, you add on that you don't even know what species is going to walk through the door, you know, and it may be something that you've never met before, you know, that there isn't any information on. And so for me in academia, you know, there are no 2 days that are exactly the same. That is for sure. My position, I see clinical patients. So last week, I saw a client that brought me 8 ducks, and she wanted me to make sure all 8 of her ducks were healthy, that none of them had any foot lesions, because ducks get a lot of pododermatitis or inflammation on their feet. And she wanted to talk about her enclosure design and make sure that what they were building for a long-term enclosure on their farm was going to be the best of the best. So I see clinical patients. I also do a lot of research. And so tomorrow, myself and my resident are getting ready to do a research project where we're looking at a brand new anesthetic agent in bearded dragons. And so we're going to be anesthetizing some bearded dragons all day and evaluating this anesthetic safety and how long these animals will be under anesthesia. And then I do a lot of teaching. So both in the classroom, I lecture to the veterinary students, which are our graduate students. And I also, as I'm receiving clinical patients, so when I was evaluating those ducks last week, I had 3 veterinary students with me that were in the 4th year of the curriculum, that they were doing the physical exams with me, and they were listening to all of the discussions that I had with the client about enclosure design and what's the best filtration system for their pond, and you know, what's the best diet for laying and non-laying ducks. And so they're learning during that experience as well. So it's hard to say. And then today's an office day. You know, I'm here talking with you and with everyone out there, and I need to do a lot of paperwork today. And unfortunately, that's a big part of every veterinarian's life, and definitely a big part of my life as well.
All right. It sounds exciting. It sounds a bit off-putting when you never know it's going to walk through the door. I thought myself, being, you know, a companion animal veterinarian, it's like, all right, is it going to have itchy skin? Is it going to have diarrhea? And for you, it's like, okay, maybe it's itchy skin that is in a koi fish. And how do you take care of that? And how do they even bring it to you? So yes, definitely keeps you on your toes. I'd like to back up just a wee bit when you're talking about zoological veterinarians, where sometimes you do go to zoos. And I know there's a lot of controversy about animals being kept in collections, being in a zoo situation. Being a zoological vet, what's your opinion about zoos in general?
Yeah, I mean, I just like a lot of veterinarians and a lot of zoo veterinarians, I grew up going to the local establishments. I'm from New England. I remember going to New England Aquarium. It's one of my earliest memories. And I think aquariums and zoos serve a couple of key important roles. And one of them is inspiring the next generation, you know, inspiring those of us who live in urban, suburban environments to understand more about the animal kingdom that doesn't include humans, you know, and that there's so much out there. And that inspiration really needs to push us as a society to focus on conservation so that these species can be with us for the next 100,000 years or whatever, you know. And part of that conservation requires that knowledge. And that knowledge begins with just being aware and being fascinated. So I think zoos and aquaria and these captive settings serve a very distinct purpose. And zoos have really, and I say zoos and mean zoos and aquaria, zoos have really risen to the occasion. You know, they take huge roles in conservation medicine, you know, where animals that are at zoos are ambassadors. Many times we're saving semen and eggs from these animals. And so there's plans for the species that semen and eggs will be used in other other animals, even when that animal has passed away, so that we can preserve that species, genetic diversity, et cetera, sort of thing. So zoos have a really important purpose in our society, especially as we become more urban and less connected with the real world, and the real world being the natural world. So I feel very, very strongly that they play an important role.
I totally concur with you, Dr. Keller, because I think sometimes the only way that our generation can get a appreciation for these animals that are on the other side of the world many times, or sometimes in your backyard, but we become so suburbanized that you don't see that coyote. You just, oh, coyotes are bad. And then all of a sudden you see it up close going, hey, that just looks like my dog. Yeah. Okay, now I understand a little bit better. And there are some zoos that are better than others. And I think it's important for us as the public and for yourself as veterinarians to make sure that they do adhere to a standard that is going to be appropriate for them, gives them that enrichment so they don't have those, what we see, the stereotypic behaviors, just walking back and forth and flying back and forth. So yes, thank you for doing what you're doing.
Of course, thank you.
So there's so many different things that you do and every day is a little bit different. What's some of the best parts about your job and what are some of the worst?
Yeah, well, the challenges of all the different species is a real seller for me. I mean, there are some days that it's frustrating, but most of the time it's really exciting. I like problem solving. I like thinking outside of the box. I just like a good challenge. And so that multi-species approach, never knowing what's going to walk in, is pretty exciting to me. I also, you know, I've chosen a part of zoological medicine, zoo companion animals, that really focuses in on not just the animal that's presenting. So let's say a rabbit that is not moving its back legs, but also that animal is presenting with a family who's very attached to that rabbit. Maybe that family is just a single human being, or maybe there are multiple human beings. And so I really, really enjoy working within that interface, that human-animal bond, where I'm helping this animal feel better, get out of pain, figure out what's wrong so that we can have a resolution. But I'm also helping that client with that relationship with the animal so that they can have hopefully a much longer relationship, but a healthier relationship, and educating that client on what's going on and how we can make this not happen in the future and all of that. So I really like the human-animal interface in the companion species. I go gaga over it. It's pretty nerdy, but that's really my thing. But, you know, I think when you're seeing, and you never know what species is going to walk in the door, there are times where it can be ultimately frustrating. A couple years ago, I had a client bring me a species of monitor lizard that had just been discovered in the wild a couple years prior. And, you know, they had a lot of questions about the care of their pet, understandably. And they kept asking me, well, what are the chances that he will survive? And I was like, I don't know. And I can't tell you. And it's not because I don't want to know or I haven't tried to know. Nobody knows. We just discovered this animal in the wild and we barely know what it's supposed to eat. So I'm having trouble giving you some of the exact information that you're looking for. So I think that can be some of the biggest challenges, is when we can't be as great of a veterinarian as we want to be with some of those novel presentations.
So you definitely have to MacGyver it. You know, all right, you can look at a zebra and go, all right, we don't know a lot about zebras maybe, but we know a lot about horses. Or we don't know a lot about this particular monitor lizard, but we do know a lot about this species and that particular variant. So yes, I see you like challenges. I also just hear the enthusiasm in your voice and the excitement that you hold for this. So I have this distinct feeling you probably have a plethora of animals at home. What's at the Keller Zoo right now?
Uh-oh. Well, the Keller Zoo, I think like most veterinarians, it fluctuates in size. You know, most veterinarians can probably agree that animals come into your care and they're part of your family for a short period of time. And then maybe you find a long-term home for them. And so that definitely happens. The core of the Keller Zoo right now includes, probably the ringleader is a 7-year-old umbrella cockatoo. Everyone who knows about cockatoos knows that they're always the ringleader. And so I did have to say him first. He has his own bedroom and is definitely the ringleader. We also, in buying our new house a couple of years ago, inherited about 30 or 40 koi in an outside pond. And that has become quite a bit of work. And then right now I have a leopard gecko. She's about 10 years of age. And we have a Mexican red-kneed tarantula of unknown age. And then I have a small dog. He's a Brussels Griffon is his breed. So that's what we have going on right now, which isn't a huge number, except if you count each of the koi individually, it gets a little intense.
All right. And I love that you have something as mundane as a dog, but then you also have a tarantula. And I do have to admit, it was years ago, somebody called me and said they had a sick tarantula and wanted to know what to do with it. And I really felt like saying, squish it. But I knew that would not be an appropriate thing for a veterinarian to say. So I will have to find someone. How do tarantulas become ill? What are their common illnesses, and what can you do for a tarantula? Can you give them a shot? See, I'm sounding like a pet owner. I have no idea.
No problem. No problem. So one of the most common reasons we get a phone call about a tarantula is it's a person who's owned a tarantula for less than a year, and the tarantula is molting for the first time. So tarantulas, they don't grow kind of continuously. They grow in kind of these leaps and bounds. And when they start growing in a leap and bound, they need to actually come out of that hard exoskeleton that they have on the exterior of their body and then grow a new one underneath. And so they molt out of this exoskeleton. And in order to do that, they lay on their back. And the molting process takes, you know, anywhere between kind of 12 and 36 hours. And the tarantula can kind of get stuck in its old molt if it's a little bit dehydrated or the environment is too dry. And so what will happen is a client will come home, their tarantula will be on their back, and they'll, you know, just kind of freak out, understandably, saying, oh my gosh, he died. But it's a completely normal process. It's a great thing, actually, to YouTube. They have time-lapse videos of tarantulas coming out of their molt. And it's really, really, really cool to watch and really educational, actually. But that's the most common reason people will call. Another thing that can happen, because there are skeletons on the outside of their body, if they fall, a lot of tarantulas are like these big-bodied spiders. If they fall, they can actually have kind of a fracture of that outside skeleton, and then they can start leaking some of their bodily fluids. They don't have blood. It's called hemolymph. And so the tarantula can actually bleed out if not addressed immediately, but a lot of people will call about that as well. So those are the two most likely phone calls. Of course, for the molting, we can cure it immediately. We can just say, why don't you give your tarantula a little bit of time and make sure the environment is nice and moist, and, you know, give us a call tomorrow when you have an excavated exoskeleton and a tarantula who's not on their back anymore. And then when we have some of those traumatic lesions, sometimes we can stop the bleeding by adding a little bit of skin glue or tissue adhesive to kind of seal that area and save them. And we can also rehydrate them. We can inject them with fluids and rehydrate their hemolymphs. Pretty cool. Pretty cool stuff for medicine.
Oh, you're crazy. I love it. Can you put a splint on their little legs?
No, usually when they have a fracture on the leg, usually it's that a piece of the leg has fallen off. And so we typically just kind of close off the leg. Or if it's broken, lots of times we'll amputate and then close off the leg. And then when they molt next time, they have the capability of growing that leg back. And so they will be normal after their next molt, typically.
Oh, I am so glad we're having this conversation. Next time somebody calls me the tarantula, it's like, excuse me, I'm calling Dr. Keller.
Yeah. Don't squish them. Yeah.
So I am chatting right now with Dr. Krista Keller. She is a diplomat of the American College of Zoological Medicine, assistant professor of zoological medicine, Department of Clinical Medicine, College of Veterinary Medicine, University of Illinois. That was long. All right, we're going to be right back after this short break. Stay tuned.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Has your pet ever suffered from digestive issues, anxiety, or joint pain? We want to address these issues and more with high-grade CBD oil from Alpha, made specifically for your furry friends. Using Alaskan salmon oil as a carrier, Alpha Pet's 500 CBD oil is lab-tested for quality, consistency, and safety. Plus, We are giving Pet Life Radio listeners 25% off and free shipping with code PL25 for a limited time. So visit myalphacbd.com/dogs now. That's myalphacbd.com/dogs. Because your furry friends are family.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to the Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio. The doctor is in, and we'll see you now.
Dr. Keller, this is just so much fun. Question for you. I know they're weird, they're unusual, they're exotic, they're just, just grabs your attention. Why do you think the public is so enamored by zoological species and they just have to have them at home?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit different for each of the species, but I think part of it might go back to the fact that we're becoming so urbanized, you know, that we don't have a lot of contact with nature in the vast majority of our lives. You know, we spend our time indoors and in urban, suburban environments, and most of us don't consider pigeons, you know, outside of our window to be wildlife. And so I think it affords, you know, having an interesting species in their house that's maybe non-traditional affords them kind of that connection to nature, to something that's not what we've built for ourselves as a human civilization. And I think, you know, there's a huge availability of species. Unfortunately, some of the availability is very concerning. You know, when you talk about some dangerous animals that are available, you know, you can Google whatever species that you want to buy, and there may be some capability for you to buy even a critically endangered species, which is just really insane and not what's best for that species the vast, vast majority of the time. So, yeah, I think it's kind of multifactorial, but I think most people are interested in having an animal in there, you know, something that's non-human in their life.
You hear about people in the news all the time. Police have raided somebody's home, oftentimes have lots and lots of money for one reason or the other, and they find a lion, or they found a bear, and most of the time they started off as that cute little bear cub, that cute little tiger cub, and now it is this huge animal that is malnourished, has skin issues, behavioral issues, etc. What are you seeing of people wanting to have a species as pets, and they know the least amount?
Yeah, I've gotten phone calls. You know, I've been practicing zoological veterinarian in a couple different states. And, you know, lots of times when I get a phone call, it is with somebody who has gotten a baby bear or a very young, some exotic felid species, even monkeys, you know. And luckily, a lot of the states have made it illegal to have those animals in your home unless you have very specific licenses. And the vast majority of the public are not going to be able to get those very specific licenses because those licenses are based upon the fact that you have housing that can keep those animals from injuring the public or you. And so, you know, I think a lot of people, I'm not sure how they come to get these animals. I usually don't want to know because it's, you know, very disturbing in many instances. The breeding of these animals and where they come from is can be a very disturbing thing as well. But yeah, no, I've gotten phone calls about some crazy things, including all of those, you know, baby bears, lots of different species of monkeys. I've gotten phone calls about bobcats and cougars, some of them taken out of the wild, where they were just kind of found in the wild. I've gotten phone calls about alligators where, you know, people thought that they were maybe a small lizard and then they kept growing and then they had a 4-foot something and they...
And it's in the bathtub and it's outgrowing the bathtub. Now what do I want to do? And I lost a cat. I wonder where it went.
Yep. So I've gotten some pretty fantastic phone calls over the years.
So people oftentimes get these animals that really they didn't know anything about. What do you wish that people knew about X? All right, so let's just maybe have a umbrella cockatoo, you say, that is really the ringleader of the house, has its own bedroom. I love it. What do you think people should know about birds if I'm going to want an exotic bird? what's a good starter bird and what are some of the pitfalls about having these little creatures?
Yeah, so I think parrots are a pretty common companion bird that we see. And a lot of my parrot clients that I meet are crazy parrot people, I guess like me. I guess I'm a reluctant crazy parrot person. But, you know, they really know a lot about parrots. They understand what their lifestyle is going to be. But I would say there's a large number of people who I meet who maybe made an emotional purchase at a pet store. You know, they saw this cute, fluffy, fuzzy animal that was mimicking them right there and was super personable and would take treats out of hand, and they just couldn't resist. And then, you know, they purchase this animal or adopt this animal without knowing anything about what their life is now going to be like. And a big thing to understand about parrots is that these animals live a very long time. You know, it's hard to say that there's a good starter parrot because even, you know, some of our very small species of parrots like budgies should live longer than a decade. And then our larger species like my cockatoo should live 50, 60, 70 years. And that's what makes me a reluctant parrot person. You know, I meet clients that have multi-generational parrots that tell me amazing stories that this parrot that they're bringing to me today is 40, 50 something years old and was their mother's bird, and that they've grown up with this bird. They've always known this bird their entire life. And even though their mother has passed away, this bird has their mother's voice, you know? And so these animals truly are very long living and should be having a very long-term plan for their care. It isn't something that you get for 2 years and then your lifestyle changes and you find a new home for them.
They very much bond to certain people. I know.
Yes.
The thing that I always hear so much about these larger birds is that they will imprint on one person, and now that person passes, you need to give them up, whatever, and this bird will self-traumatize, pick all its feathers out, have these neurotic episodes and medical issues that they need someone such as yourself and that behaviorist, and it can be a lot of money.
Yeah, I would say probably the thing even established parrot people maybe don't appreciate is that the vast majority of disorders that we diagnose in parrots are sexual in nature. You know, a lot of people get parrots when they are young and they're prepubertal. They haven't gone through puberty yet. A large species of parrot like my cockatoo doesn't start puberty until 5 years of age. And during that prepubertal period, they are babies. You know, they're super sweet, they're cuddly, and clients will set up these really inappropriate behaviors with them where they're kissing on the mouth, where they're petting all over the body. And for a baby, that's okay. But for an adult, those behaviors are construed as sexual behaviors. And that's where we get a lot of our abnormal behaviors from parrots. This is where screaming comes from, where maybe a bird is attached to the wife in the family, and the wife does maybe some of those behaviors with the bird that the bird is seeing as sexual. And then the bird starts seeing the husband as competition, and so starts screaming at or attacking the husband once they reach puberty. It can also be why, you know, birds have, parrots in captivity have a high incidence of removing feathers, traumatizing their body. And some of that, not all of it, but some of that can be associated with the fact that they're sexually frustrated. You know, these are birds who don't necessarily know that they're a macaw or a cockatoo. They think that they're a human and they're wondering why that human doesn't want to mate with them, sort of thing. And so we actually see a lot of sexual disorders, and it can be very uncomfortable to talk about with your clients, you know, especially when that sexual behavior is happening in the exam room in front of you. And you have to point out, he is not dancing on your shoulder. He's actually masturbating on your shoulder. And that is a very uncomfortable conversation to have with a client who is really bonded to their parrot. And of course, that parrot who is very bonded to that client. And so I wish people would know more about sexual disorders of parrots before they even thought about, you know, purchasing one or adopting one, for sure.
So we're going to have to change your name from Dr. Krista Keller to Dr. Ruth Keller. Yeah. So Dr. Ruth. All right. I guess I had never really thought about them masturbating on the shoulder. That can be a little bit uncomfortable. All right. Let's change before we all start blushing about, oh, that's what that bird's doing. How about reptiles? I know a lot of people are so into snakes and lizards and all these various creatures. And for one, before I got into veterinary medicine, snakes, like for many people, just, they really freaked me out. I did not like them. And then I was working with a veterinarian that made me work at the far end. And that wasn't a good end because when they get scared, they poop and pee all over you and it's really stinky. So then I decided to work up to the other end and just watch out for their teeth. But what do people need to know about reptiles in general? Do we have sexual issues with them too?
We do. We have a lot of egg laying issues where, you know, I think that the biggest thing with reptile species is that if you think about the vast majority of reptiles that we're keeping in captivity as part of our families, they're from really exotic areas of the world, you know, so all the monitor lizards, none of them are from North America. They're all from places like Indonesia and Africa. And so when we're pulling them into our homes in, for instance, Illinois, we really have to create a very structured artificial environment, you know, a place that this animal lives that is replicating the heat, the humidity, providing the diet, providing the artificial lighting so we can
think replicate. They're still back home, right?
Yes, thinks it's back home. And without all of that specialized equipment in order to provide the artificial environment, these animals suffer. You know, if they're not at the correct temperature, which in Illinois, you know, it's really hot this time of year. And so animals who are from hot areas of the world don't need as much support with lighting and bulbs and heat lamps and all that. But in the winter, they need a lot of support. And so without all of that, they'll have medical issues. You know, they'll come in with things like metabolic bone disease, where they don't have enough calcium because they don't have the right lighting. They'll have chronic infections because their temperatures are just too low, or they'll be chronically dehydrated because their temperatures are too high. And so, you know, thinking about not only what does this species of reptile require, but can I replicate this in my home in a realistic way? And do I have the finances, because it's annually pretty expensive to replace some of these bulbs and some of the equipment. Do I have that drive for the next, you know, however long this animal lives? And some of them do live very long. My leopard gecko, the longest living leopard gecko, has lived 27 years. Mine is 10. You know, I still have a good two lives to live for this leopard gecko. So knowing all of that specialized equipment that's required and that knowledge, you know, where do you find all that knowledge? A lot of times on the internet, you know, so many clients come to me and they've done so much searching on the internet, but they've just found the wrong web pages that have some pretty bad information. And so they're left with a sick animal that they've really tried really hard to maintain an artificial environment and just been having some bad advice.
So when in doubt, actually see a veterinarian. And I admit, I am not the veterinarian who has the information that you do. So hopefully most veterinarians, and if you're a pet owner and you're taking your non-traditional zoological pet to a veterinarian, they go, huh, I think it's a tarantula that you need to squish. Don't, you know, find a specialist, find someone, they can research it for you. So terribly important. You're mentioning that at the Keller Zoo, you have koi, and I decided I wanted to have, I love water features in my garden. So I have this large pot, and I went to the store, I'll admit Walmart, and I got myself 3 little goldfish. Well, I'm down to 1 goldfish, and the thing is huge. And I thought he might need a friend. So I got him a little friend, and he tried to eat his little friend. So what do people need to know about goldfish, fish in general? Do they need friends? Oh, please enlighten me.
Yeah, so I think goldfish and fish in general tend to be touted as these easy species or starter species, or I want to teach my 8-year-old about responsibility and so forth.
Yes.
I'm a fish, right? And what I would say is that are goldfish in general simpler to take care of than a marine tropical fish, and a, you know, most definitely, they are so much simpler. However, a lot of these species that are touted as being very easy to take care of, what ends up happening is if you talk to people, they say, oh yeah, they're so easy. You just throw food in, you know, I don't know, every other day and change some water, you know, once a week. If you actually talk to those people, many of those fish aren't actually living the life expectancy that we would expect. So many times betta fish fall into this kind of category of an easy keeper. And you talk to a lot of people and they're like, oh yeah, my betta fish live 2 years. And I'm like, wait a minute. You know, maybe what you're providing for, you know, what's easy isn't really the best. You know, we could really do a lot better because betta fish can live, you know, 6 to 8 years. So this animal probably died of disease and that it wasn't being cared for properly. And so, you know, fish are another one, just like reptiles, they require an artificial environment. They can't even breathe air like we breathe air. You know what I mean? We have to give them an aqueous environment. And I think probably the biggest issue with fish is that their tanks are just dirty. You know, think about they eat and they go to the bathroom in the very same media, which is a bowl of water. And many of these quote unquote easy fish, it's touted that you don't need a filtration system, you know, that you just change their water out maybe 30% every week. And in fact, that's kind of gross if you think about it. You know, if you put things into perspective, you would not want to live in that environment. And so many of these animals who are touted as easy kind of get this sad life, especially when they are, you know, maybe given to an 8-year-old sort of thing. The other problem is you kind of touched upon is that there's so many people selling goldfish, you know, that they've become, you know, they're sold as feeder fish. Anyone can, you know, breed a goldfish and set up a sale for them. A lot of the big stores sell goldfish. And so the availability is really high, which also just makes them really available. And that a lot of people will try them out as a first pet and maybe not have all the information that they need about taking care of these animals to the best ability, you know, to have them live, you know, some extraordinary lifetime, which they can, you know, goldfish. I've met goldfish that were 12 years of age that were a little comet feeder fish, and I did cataract surgery on them when they were 10 years of age. You know, like they can live extraordinary lives, but they do need to have, they're not as easy as I think people indicate that they are for care.
Dr. Keller, this has been amazing, and we could go on for another couple of hours discussing what you have at home, what I'm doing wrong with my, yes, goldfish, and definitely not squishing things anymore in the future. Thank you so much. If people have questions about their zoological pets, what's one of the best ways for them to get information on how to take care of them?
Well, I think engaging with a veterinarian who feels comfortable, we've talked about this, it's just really important. Even before you get, you know, whatever species you're thinking about getting, whether it's a moray eel or a rabbit, making sure that you have veterinary support both for emergency care as well as preventative care is really important. And a lot of the veterinary associations have search-a-vet options. So for instance, if you're thinking about getting a cockatoo, think about it long and hard, people, but the Association of Avian Vets or AAV has a find a vet kind of search capability on their website. So you could find a veterinarian who is either a specialist or somebody who feels extremely comfortable helping you with your animal. And so all of the different veterinary associations have that search a vet capability to help you find somebody who can really help you out.
Awesome. Great information. I so appreciate you being with us today. So much fun. I think I'm definitely going to have you back, and maybe we'll just concentrate on individual species and take it from there. So Dr. Krista Keller, thank you again. So assistant professor, zoological medicine, University of Illinois. This is Dr. Bernadine Cruz. You've been listening to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio. Please tune in again next week. We'll give you more information on how to make you the best possible pet owner. Thanks for listening.
Pets can be a wonderful addition to your life because they're a member of the family. Keeping them healthy and happy is important. Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor with veterinary media consultant and veterinarian Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets. The Pet Doctor, on demand every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.